Hey, Ellen, here we go. I am your host with the most, I guess, Brett, with, Mr. Brett Podcast, that is. And I've got my regular co-host, the Crown Prince of Charisma, Mo. How are you doing, Mo?
See, we got our own nicknames. It may not be as cool as Crash, but there's our own nicknames. Crown Prince of Charisma, and he's the king of the casters over there. The We Talk Music Podcast. We have a great guest. We're really excited. We seem to have caught him in a good mood, even if a little off guard. Christy Majors.
I'm always in a good mood. Hello, guys. How you doing?
All right. Well, why wouldn't you be? It's rock and roll, right?
Life's too short, you know?
Absolutely.
Enjoy every minute.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Brett, you take the lead here.
All right. Well, firstly, I just want to thank you so much for being on the show. And, let's start by talking about Pretty Boy Floyd. It seems like a natural and Public Enemies.
That's not the lead we wanted to take. Now, I didn't mean to take over here, but I got to be honest with you. We talked to 6 a.m. this morning. We had to get up because the guy's in Italy. We talked to David Reese.
Who'd you talk to?
David Reese, Bangalore Choir, Accept lead singer. And I don't know if you know him or not, but, he's with Bonfire. And we talked to him, and pretty much right away he started in with some tranny stories. So I'm like, every interview
tranny
should
stories?
Start if we should at least check. Like, shouldn't we just see? I mean, it's rock and roll. There must be some crazy moment.
I don't specifically have a tranny story. I have my dad had a tranny story when he was in the military, but I think that went on constantly overseas during World War II. My dad had a great one. I've had some I'm not going to call them near gay experiences. I'm going to call them more like gay guys trying to come on to me and trying to, convert me for the first time. And I'm like, hey, man, you're going down the wrong path, man. I don't care what you're saying. In fact, it was the guy from fucking, can I cuss?
Oh, yeah.
No, please do.
Oh yeah, it was the fucking guy who was on ER.
Oh, I don't know the name. Oh no.
Anyway, I was at this place at the Beauty Bar. And this is a long time ago. I was at this place called the Beauty Bar that's on the Cahuenga Crawl here in Hollywood, right? And this guy, I'm out in the back smoking a cigarette and I'm drinking a beer, and it's like kind of like this like small little area. And he puts his hand, and I recognize him from the ER. I'm like, hey, you're that guy, blah, blah, blah. He's like, yeah, I'm always very friendly, yeah. And I'm sitting down, I'm smoking a cigarette, and he puts his hand on my thigh, and he goes, and I'm like, just kind of slapping it off with my hand. And then he puts it right back again, and I'm like, hey. I don't know where you're going with this, but ain't going to happen. And he goes, have you ever had your cock sucked by a man? And I go, no. And he goes, you don't know what you're missing, because I could do it better than any woman that you've ever been with. And I'm like, good to know. But you know what? I don't think my cock would even get hard. Okay. So I don't know how you would say that it would be the best experience I ever had. And I'm like, hey, look, I have nothing wrong with gay people. It's all good. You're cool. You're good. You're a good looking guy. It's all good. I'm comfortable with my sexuality. But you know what? I don't bat for that team. Sorry.
That's a good story.
And then I had another experience where I was up at Billy Idol's ex-wife's house up in the Hollywood Hills, where another guy literally threw me in the pool with my clothes on. And it was fucking freezing. And so I was like, hey, I go, do you have a washer and dryer or something like that? I need to dry my clothes. So she gives me this little bathrobe. So I'm hanging out and I'm like, okay, I got this little bathrobe. This guy just kept on trying to run past me and rip off my freaking bathrobe. I'm like, don't go there, man. It ain't going to happen. I don't know what it is, man. I mean, Jesus Christ, don't you guys have gaydar?
It's a compliment. It's a compliment. They found you attractive, and it's good to know though you were never in a situation where you thought you were playing with a baseball and it turned out you were playing with a bat, which is what some people happens to them. So
yeah. So yeah. So I thought, yeah, exactly, right? So, hey, I'm in the Me Too movement. No, I'm joking. Me too. Come on. Men can get sexually abused as well.
Oh, those are some good stories. Now we can talk Pretty Boy Floyd. Now we've broken ground.
There we go. Yeah, we
should have told you we are recording.
You know, I don't know if you guys have noticed, but I'm like no filter. So
that's great.
Perfect. That's the way we like it. Filters are stupid.
Yeah.
Well, that's,
yeah. I mean, I listen to so many interviews and I'm like, oh, this is boring as shit. Come on, I've heard these same answers and questions like literally 20 times. Give me some good stuff. Give me some juicy stuff. Let's talk about some, you know, good stuff.
Trannies. All right. I mean, if nothing else, I doubt anybody else has asked you that lately.
I've never offered that information before.
Well, there you go. Man, that's actually all we want. Let's just go with all the information you've never offered before.
In fact, I'm going to go on Twitter and I'm going to do a Me Too tweet after you guys do this.
That's awesome.
I just get reminded because we have that giant sign on Sunset Boulevard now. That's like, you know, right across the street from the whiskey. And I see it every day. And I'm just like, ugh. Can we just say that literally every man in show business who lives in, you know, Los Angeles or New York or something like that has done something, whether it's verbally, touch somebody, ask somebody out on a date, whatever, that was maybe unwelcomed. Can we just say that and then just like be over with it? Okay, every man's guilty. Done.
It's getting really hard to tell the line, isn't it? Like, I hear about some of the stories and it's obvious, but some of the stories you're like, shit, man, like it's, I don't know where, you know, like what would I do in that situation? Like, I don't know. I mean, if you're just with somebody and you're kind of like, you know, suggesting more than once that you should do it. Is that like now some sort of, I don't know, harassment? Like it's getting scary.
It's getting really scary. And you know what? And unfortunately, you know, people are, you know, look, we've become to a point where it's like, you're guilty until proven innocent now. It's not like, oh, innocent until proven guilty, because these people are losing their jobs. You know, they're losing their whole career over everything. Just from somebody just, you know, accusing, just making an accusation. And I really think it's unfair, you know. And, you know, for the people that it did happen to, that sucks.
Oh yeah,
and I feel bad for them, and I'm glad they're speaking out. The people who are really abused, but you know, I mean, hey, look, Taylor Swift, you know, getting you know a guy, you know, maybe had his hand resting on her butt. Come on, man.
Yeah,
you know, you're a woman. You're a woman. It's just like, okay, is that really sexually abuse? I don't know.
It's so tough. It's getting really tough.
Yeah, and I gotta say, there's a I'm a business owner as well, you know, and I gotta tell you, you know, it's like, you know, if I had to hire a staff of like, you know, I mean, I don't have a staff of like 20, 30, you know, 30 people or more. I mean, I have a smaller staff of like, you know, 4 people, but I would be, if I was a man, I would be very uncomfortable, or a woman, and I owned a company, I'd be very uncomfortable about having men and women in my workplace, because I would be scared that I was going to be subjected to some sort of a lawsuit. So I think it's a combination where it's doing a disservice to women as well, in the long run, because I don't know if they're going to get, you know, if they're going to get jobs, you know, I mean, think about it. If you owned a company, would you hire a woman?
You know, it's
in today's climate.
You know, it's one of those things where when you hear about the stories, like you say, the Harvey Weinstein, that type of thing, where, you know, people are covering up for him and everybody knows and that type of, like, that's horrible. That's unacceptable. But when you hear
Yeah, and they're making them sign confidentiality agreements,
that's
and
terrible.
All that kind of stuff. Yeah.
And you know, some of the stuff in the government, all the you know, different people doing things, and it turns out the taxpayers are paying for the payoffs, and like this shit is not good. But on the other hand, yeah, there's a point where it's like, you know, you look back and you think, I did this, and it was like the most innocent thing, and it could still come back on me personally, you know.
Right.
And all of a sudden, it's like, how do we function, you know?
How do we function as a society now?
Yeah.
You know, I don't understand, you know. And going back to the Harvey Weinstein thing, I got to tell you, the thing that pisses me off about some of these people that are coming out, you know, now, as opposed to when it happened, they obviously had a working relationship with Harvey. They went on to do other movies with Harvey after the incidents had happened. So, you know, they got paid from doing movies with them, getting successful, becoming a huge actress or something, you know. And then, you know, now that maybe, you know, work has slowed down for them, their career is kind of stalled and nobody wants to hire them anymore. Now they're coming out with these stories. Why didn't you do it back then?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that.
Why would you continue working with the man?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I wasn't in their situation, so, and it's such a gray area. I don't know the dynamics, right, of what exactly went on with them and why they would continue work here or not. I'm sure it's not. I mean, it's Hollywood. It's not. You know, it's 1% of 1% that has any success at all. So, I mean, you're really backed into a corner. So, I mean, I don't know if having success kind of forgives the behavior that he did necessarily. On the other hand, I know that there's a gray area though, where it's like, you know, like I say, some things are obvious, but you know, I mean,
yeah,
you know, well, taking out your dick and jacking off in front of somebody, you can't do that, right? You know, or coming into a plant, you know, potted plant, like he apparently did in front of people, stuff like that. It's just, you know, obviously you can't do that.
Oh,
on the other hand, if you're on a date with a girl and you're kissing her and you don't get her signals that she wants you to stop, is that now enough? Like that's the thing. Is it? It's like everything starts to become a gray area because everything's just so fucked up.
Right. Well, the whole let's just face the fact now. We are in 2018. The whole world is fucked up. The internet is fucked up.
Yeah.
There's so much hate. There's so much crap going on the internet. You know, and now we have it with the females in the workplace, and then you know we had with the Black Lives Matter and everything like that, and then we've had these marches and everything, and then obviously we've had all these killings all over the place. The whole world is screwed up. You know, and can it be fixed? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Go ahead, bro.
The power of music will fix it.
You know?
Brett tried to take it back to a music podcast. I'm sure this isn't something you've been talking about lately, actually, on a show anyways. But
yeah, we need Jack Black to get in there and be like, you know, and God came down and saved the United States. Rock and roll, you know.
That'd be awesome.
Bad to happen. I don't know.
If the United States could be saved by rock and roll, that would be the greatest thing in history.
It sounds like a song title right there. You know, I'm sure it is. Saved by rock and roll. Somebody's got to have done that, right?
I don't know. I think the closest thing we had to that was the Kiss song, "The God Gave Rock and Roll to Us."
That's right.
That's
right. That's a good one, though. There's a good one. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things we know about you. I mean, you definitely, you in your music and your everything you do, I mean, you really pay tribute to those artists that you grew up with and everything. I mean, that's one of the things that we respect about you.
Kiss.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorite bands growing up as a child, all the way up until... obviously all those, I think their first 7 studio records and even the 2 double live records are just iconic staples in my music repertoire. And I when it comes time to reflect on Pretty Boy Floyd or write put together Pretty Boy Floyd music, it's like I always go back to like, oh yeah, we need those big power chords and we need those big anthem choruses. And that's the music that I love, you know, the bands that did that kind of stuff, you know, and obviously Kiss was probably one of the best bands that did it.
So music from the Elder, is that what you're thinking? See, the funny thing is that I'm a huge fan of Kiss as well, but I really love music from the Elder, but I think it's just for a different moment. Like, it's all, you can't listen to it in the same sitting as the first one, but I still really like it myself. I'm crazy.
Just don't think of it as a Kiss album.
You know what? It's a bizarre record. I give them props. Obviously, Bob Ezrin, right? He did that record, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, Bob Ezrin went in and changed Kiss for the better when he did Destroyer, right? I mean, Destroyer is like one of the most iconic records that Kiss had done, right? And you know, and then they took a break from him, and I think they went to somebody else, and they did what, Creatures of the Night and some other stuff. And then, but then they came back, and he did the Elder, and I think Bob Ezrin just like took it up even to like a whole other level, you know. And I was just listening to it actually. I have one of those like Amazon Alexas, and I hook it up to my little to my iPad, and I go on YouTube, and you know how they have, you know, they have like the full albums on YouTube, you know, and I'll just like put it on and I'll crank it and listen to it. And I was just listening to the Elder the other day, and I was like, you know, some of these songs are pretty freaking good, you know. Mm-hmm. And some of them are really good songs, and the production on this is incredible. So,
man, it's one of those things. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and listening to Paul Stanley singing in those like those operatic voices and stuff like that and everything. I think that prepared him for like him doing what was it, the Phantom of the Opera?
Phantom of the Opera, yeah.
I think it was something that he wanted to explore.
You'd never know that he could do the falsetto voice until that moment.
Yeah, right, because he was just like a real, just like power rock vocalist, you know, and he had such a strange delivery and such a distinct voice to his sound that when you heard it, you immediately knew that was Paul Stanley. And I always latched onto vocalists that were like that. You know, as soon as you hear the voice, you know that's that band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, that's no that question. Person. I love voices like that, that are so distinct, you know, and that really creates that sound for that band, as having that voice that's like so distinctive, instead of just like a middle of the road voice that could you can listen to it and you can be like, oh, okay, I don't know this song, and I really don't know who this is. It's a good song, but I don't know who it is.
So, who are some of those other ones? Those other vocalists then that I mean, really, really latched onto then.
Oh, you know, I mean, anybody who's, anybody who had, like, distinct voices, obviously, Freddie Mercury, oh, my God, one of the most amazing rock and roll singers of all time, probably, if not the best. And I have a real eclectic taste in music, even, like, George Michael, I gotta tell you, on his later stuff that he did, like, the Listen Without Prejudice record, freaking incredible, freaking haunting music and haunting vocals. And I think he was doing Freddie some, you know, he was doing some clean stuff for a while, singing some songs with them, you know. And Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, yeah.
Undeniable.
Yeah, not the greatest singer in the world, but super distinct voice.
Distinctive, for sure.
Yeah, very distinctive voice. As soon as you hear Ozzy, bam, you know that's Ozzy, you know? And Rob Halford, you know, it's like, you know it's him right off the bat, you know? There's some great vocalists, obviously. Brian Johnson, Jesus Christ, you know, Bon Scott. I mean, there's a lot of them out there. And, you know, and these are why these bands were so successful and are still successful to this day, and have become, you know, legends, you know.
Yeah,
they had that distinctive sound.
It's so easy to go back and always think, you know, I want to listen to something like that. And then the second that you hear it, you're right back there. And it does help when you have that distinctive voice in front.
Yeah.
I think that's
Dio.
Oh,
Dio's amazing.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Seeing him live was
another one.
Yeah, it's just, you know, yeah, him and Halford are amazing.
Yeah, and it's crazy when you see you meet Ronnie and he's, you know, what, you know, 5'2", but when you know, when he's singing, it's belting out like, you know, he's a freaking giant, you know.
Yeah, it is amazing. Crazy. His power. Wow.
And you, I mean, obviously you started doing some singing yourself, started, like, how did you approach it then? And what did you think you could do with your voice? Or are you able to do the things with your voice you want to do?
Obviously not. No, it's like, it's very hard for me. I have to triple track, four track my vocals. And, obviously I have to do a little bit of treatment to them and stuff. And I can make it sound okay in the studio. But live, it's a different animal because I've done a couple of live things here and there, you know, did like a short little live, you know, Christy Majors tour overseas. And, I've done like, I think like two shows here, and I've had a problem because I would go to rehearsal and I would rehearse like 3 or 4 days or something before I would do it. And then my voice would be thrown out by the third rehearsal because I'm not singing right. You know, I was never trained. I never knew how to do it and everything. So, and then I would get up on stage and I'd be like, trying to sing live, you know, it's a hard thing to do, you know, and I think, singing correctly obviously is a big step in that, you know, you have to know how to sing correctly. And then, there's that resting the voice and doing the voice warm ups and everything. And, you know, I don't got the time for that shit, you know, so just give me a guitar. I'm cool.
There you go. Now, how do you approach the guitar then? Do you work on it on like a daily basis, or is it kind of a rote thing by now that you just understand the instruments and you know what you want to do?
I have no idea what I'm doing. I always say I never studied music. I mean, but the first song I learned how to play on an acoustic guitar was Blitzkrieg Bop, you know, and that was like pretty much the extent of my guitar lessons. But I always say I'm like the Nikki Sixx of a guitar, you know. It's like I do enough just to get by, and that's about it. And I don't practice, I don't do anything, you know. It's like, I'm like, okay, you know, it's like, even when we were doing the new Public Enemies record, you know, I was like, time to do guitar solos. I was just dreading it. I was like, okay, you know what? I got to rehearse these freaking guitar solos because I don't even know what I'm playing. And when I create a guitar solo, I try to make it somewhat melodic instead of just a bunch of, which I can't even do anyway because I never practice. So, I try to make a melodic and I sing something in my head, along to the, tracks in my, you know, when I listen to it at home and I go like, da, 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 and then I try to figure out the notes on the guitar and then I just slowly just put it together and I'll just work on one song for like 2 or 3 days and I'll be like, oh, okay, that sounds kind of cool. And then I go into the studio and obviously, you know, it's punching in and punching out to try and get it right. You know, like I said, the Nikki Sixx of guitar, that's me, man.
But, you know,
I never aspired to be, some sort of great guitar player. It wasn't what I wanted to do. I just wanted to be, the people that I admired were like, you know, Ace Frehley, Johnny Thunders, Johnny Ramone. I was just like, and they were super sloppy guitar players. But there was like, there was something to say about how their slop, even Jimmy Page, you know, how their slop created a unique sound for them.
Well, I can definitely, you know, say that when it comes to like song creation, I would rather listen to a great song that has a sloppy guitar than a guitar virtuoso who can play over top of the song and sound amazing, but really doesn't bring anything other than, say, arpeggios to the song.
Yeah. Look, I can watch those people and I could be like, wow, that's a freaking amazing guitar player. I can never do that ever. And I can appreciate the talent that goes along with that. But yeah, to me, it was all about like the package. It's got it's the song. It fits into the context of what the band is doing and what the band is trying to accomplish. You know, I mean, Mick Mars is a great example of that. You know, Ace Frehley is a great example of that. You know, they played, hopefully we don't find out, you know, in another year from now that Ace Frehley didn't play any of the guitar solos on Ace Frehley. I don't know. I hope that's not the case because more things have been coming out and coming out and coming out lately. And I'm just like, really? Holy shit. But hopefully he did play on those records that I grew up to love. But it's putting the song in context and like, you know, things that I loved about Ace was that, you know, he can like ring out a note for a while and just make it sound cool and it fits in the song and it sounds great, you know, and he's not like trying to do anything speedy or anything, and neither is, you know, Mick Mars or anything. And same thing with Johnny Thunders. It was just like straight ahead, off the cuff, rock and roll, you know, and a lot of stuff that Jimmy Page was doing. It was the same thing, you know. There was no shredding arpeggios going on and that stuff, you know. And it fit the music. It would be great. I mean, could you imagine like AC/DC, you know, Back in Black, and it comes up to the guitar solo and all of a sudden it just starts going to... It would ruin the song.
Oh, man.
You know what? There's times that, you know, I've known bands and they're doing great music and they have some reason or another a guitarist will leave and they'll replace them with somebody who's a better guitarist and not make as good music. It's an insane thing, but it happens.
Yeah. You know what? I mean, you don't have to be the greatest musicians in the world to make great music. And obviously, you know, have all those puzzles of each member bringing something to the table that just makes it work.
Well, it comes down to chemistry.
And, yeah, it's just the chemistry and everything. You know, if it works, it works. You know, but yeah, if you have like, you know, something sticking out like a sore thumb, like a drummer that's overplaying, or a guitar player that's overplaying, or even a bass player that's overplaying, or a singer could even be like, you know, constantly throwing in those, you know, all over the freaking record. It would just ruin it, you know? So everybody just has to know their part and just like go, this is what I bring to the table, and this is what I do, and this is what I bring to the table, and this is what I do, and put all the pieces of the puzzle together, and it works.
So then I'd like to ask about your chemistry with Steve Summers in this case, because, I mean, Pretty Boy Floyd is the band that we certainly know you from. And, I mean, it seems like Pretty Boy Floyd really is you and Steve.
You know what? It always kind of felt like that, you know. Drummers and bass players just don't matter. I'm sorry.
Oh, jeez.
You know, shut up and play your drums. You have nothing right now. Shut up and play your bass. You have four strings, man. You don't matter, you know? And you're probably only using two of them, so just get a two-string bass.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm just joking. But, I have this love for the same types of music. And it just, you know, when I first met Steve... back in like 87, you know, everybody was, you know, very naive, and, you know, we were, I think I was the only person in the Floyd camp that actually had, you know, recorded demos or actually had some material that was on, you know, records released to the public, you know, whether it be Metal Blade compilation records or a Lemoore's Brooklyn record and stuff like that, you know. And I had played out extensively live in New York City for many years. And when I met the Pretty Boy Floyd guys, you know, they had never played a live show. They had never recorded a demo. They had never done anything, you know. And, but the thing I liked about it was Kerry was just, you know, he was a very young drummer. He'd only been playing for a couple of years. And his drumming style was just so unorthodox and just so strange that I really latched onto it. And I really liked him a lot. And Vinny, you know, like I said, the bass player, I love Vinny, rest in peace. But he was a bass player, so you know, all he had to do was just go do 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 do. Said, "Thank you. That's just do that. That's good. Perfect." But Steve had that iconic voice that I just loved. It was
distinctive for sure.
Yeah, it was a distinctive voice, and he sang in that high register that I really like. I don't know if people really realize that if they really listen to the Pretty Boy Floyd stuff. The registers of the songs where Steve's singing it's in a higher register than, you know, than most bands. So I liked the guys when I first met them, and I was just like, yeah, we could do something with this and we can make it into a really great band because, you know, everybody was bringing their own little thing to the table and everybody had their own little distinctive personalities, which I also like too, which is what we're missing from the music world today. Obviously, you know, if the guys from the Killers were, you know, knocking on my door and saying, "Hey, what's up, man? Hey," I'd be like, "Yeah, who the fuck are you?"
Yeah. Well, I love their music, but you're totally
the
right.
Killers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love their music. And I hear the song, and I'm like, yeah, this is great songs. But yeah, no, if I was an Uber driver and they, you know, and somebody picked the lead singer up, I wouldn't even know it was him.
No.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's so true.
Yeah, so we've missed, I mean, back in the 80s, you know, and even in the 90s, to an extent, you know, from that whole Seattle scene, you weren't able to name at least two guys in the band. And in the 80s, you were probably, be able to name all the members in the band. And slowly as we, right, you know, I mean, because, you know, I mean, we all knew who everybody in Rat was. We all knew who everybody in Motley Crue was. We all knew who everybody in Poison was. You know, we knew all these people. You know, we knew their names. They had distinctive personalities, distinctive looks, and you know, even a lot of the 80s new wave bands too. Same thing. And then we traveled into the, you know, the 90s realm, but we still knew, you know, the guys in Soundgarden. We still knew the guys' names in Alice in Chains, Pearl Jam, you know, Nirvana, all that stuff. We knew these people because they were distinctive as well, too. But then after that, we sort of tailed off into this kind of like lost, you know, faceless, nameless bands.
Yeah, you're blowing my mind here because I never thought of it, and it's so damn true. Like, it's one of the things that's changed a lot.
Yeah, because the record companies were just like, "Oh, okay, we got we got two good songs from this band. We know we can get these two great songs on the radio, and that's all that matters. And we'll sell a million records. We'll sign them to a 360 deal. We'll take a piece of their touring, their publishing, and their record sales, and everything that they do. And it's a no lose situation for us. And of course, the band will be in the." So, you know, they'll be broke, 2 years later, because they signed a shitty deal. But they're faceless and nameless. I mean, I don't know. You listen to the radio and you hear songs, you'll know the song only because they force feed it down your freaking throat. Right. And, but you don't know, you can't, sometimes you can't even name the name of the band. You know, the song, but sometimes you know, there's that one song. I don't remember what it was, but I like the song a lot. And I see the video and I'm just like, okay, it's a cool song. I think it was some song like, "Why Did You Have to Cut Me Up?" I don't know. I don't remember what the song was, but it was a very catchy melodic song. To this day, I still don't know what the name of the band is. I definitely couldn't tell you who is in the band.
One of the things that I think is that it's interesting when you say that, because it's like back you know, when I think about 80s and the hard rock scene, like, even if 10 bands sounded exactly alike, you could tell them apart by their personalities. But now they're not even trying to do that. 10 bands sound exactly alike, and it's just the marketing machine, and then it just chews them up and spits them out, like you say. And I still don't know, I mean, any, like, you could take one song from each, put it on one album, and I'd be like, oh, that's an interesting album. The lead singer sounds a bit different on track three, but that's about it.
Yeah, exactly. You know what's really taking over and taking the place of, like, you know, that 80s and 90s era has been the female vocalist and the rap music. Mm-hmm. They have, I could name more rappers than I can, more current rappers than I can name, guys in bands right now. I can name more female artist names than I can name guys in bands right now.
Yeah.
Or girls in bands.
No, that's
taking the place. And obviously they're making, you know, there's lots of money and making, you know, these like outlandish, crazy music videos that I kind of think that it was kind of like what we were doing in the 80s. We were making these over-the-top music videos, and now they started doing that, you know? And so I think that has now taken the place. You know, you got the Taylor Swifts and the Katy Perrys and the Miley Cyruses and all that stuff. You know all those people, you know their names, blah, 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 you know, and they're making these, you know, iconic, I don't know if you want to call them iconic videos, but they're spending a lot of money making videos that are only going to be seen on YouTube, you know.
Well, I'm interested.
And, yeah.
Well, I'm just interested in your opinion, because when I think about it, it almost seems like music now is being made by the labels and by the recording industry more than it is by people getting together, forming a band, and making music together.
Yeah, they hire songwriters and they hire producers to create a sound the exact same for one artist that they created for their last artist, you know?
Max Martin and Dr. Luke. I mean, it's if you want to be a female artist and you want to, you want to sell a couple million records and be a pop artist, you got to go to Max Martin or Dr. Luke. I mean, that's just the bottom line. Right. You know, and so all the records kind of sound the same. They sound similar because they're using the same songwriters and using the same producers, and they're doing the same things on every single one of their recordings, just with the different vocals, you know? And I think a lot of the rappers are doing that the same way too. They're using the same producers and the same, you know, they're doing the same things, you know,
auto-tune's and, killing me too. That auto-tune, one of the things that I can't tell people apart by is because they're all using that. So all of a sudden, when I hear it, I just walk away. Like nothing sticks out. Nothing sticks at all.
It's an effect that really needs to go away.
Yeah.
It just needs to go away. Please, just stop it.
Overdone.
I mean, how much longer can we really hear the auto-tune? I mean, stop it. Just stop it already. I can't stand it. Yeah,
I'm
crazy.
I'm here.
I mean, it was cool. It was cool in, you know, Styx's, Don't Worry, Gato, Mr. Roboto. It was cool. You know, it was cool that it kind of like had some weird kind of like auto-tune effect. I think that was before auto-tune, obviously. But, you know, if you place it in a certain part of the song, cool. But through the whole entire song, come on, man, I'm tired of it.
Well, and just using it to fix up the like an obviously not good voice.
You know, the funny thing is like the funny thing. Okay, you know what? I got to tell you, it's like I listened to the Taylor Swift records. Well, the last two records I've listened to, and I actually bought them. Oh my God, should I say that? I shouldn't even say that.
Credibility. Woo.
There goes my whole image. I was just listening to one of her songs. And that I heard on the radio, one of my rare days that I was actually listening to music on the radio. And I was like, you know what? I'm like, this is the same chord progression through the whole entire song. But what they're doing is they're layering vocals, or they're taking out like certain things, or they're making the hi-hats a little interesting, or they're adding hand claps in certain spots to bring the song up or change the mood of the song and bring it down and bring it up and bring it up. But it's just literally the same chord structure through the whole entire song. And I was fascinated by that. I was like, God, how can you just play the same four chords through the whole entire song and still make it sound catchy and interesting without people getting bored with it and go, oh, this is a shitty song. I can't stand it. Right. And let's face it, a good song is a good song. I don't care if it's country, rap, whatever. A good song is a good song. I can recognize it. And I'm not like one of those guys like, oh, it's got to be rock. It's got to be rock. If it's not rock, I don't dig it. You know, I'm not like that. A good song is a good song. So I bought those freaking records and I just started listening to them and I'm like going, Jesus Christ. I'm like, I'm just listening to the production value on it. And I'm like going, my God, it's just amazing what they do. It's just literally every single song almost has the same chord progression. And it's just changing up with some like effects and some keys. And like I said, but the new Taylor Swift record, she's got auto-tune all over that freaking record. And I know she can sing. That's just really bizarre. I was just like, really? You got to put auto-tune all over there? I'm like, you could sing. Mm-hmm. I've seen her live. I'm like, she can sing. I'm like, why is she putting auto-tune on there? I don't know. What? Just stop it. Please take it off.
You think they'd want people to know that they're such good singers? You know?
I don't know. Like I said, I think it's just these producers that have been doing it for so long. And that's their formula for success. And so, they keep on doing it. They're gonna keep on doing it until they can't get any more work, you know. But if they're still selling millions of records and putting millions of dollars in their pocket every year, they're going to keep on doing it. I mean, it was kind of like a similar thing in the 80s where it's just like, okay, this is the formula. You know, you do a rock song and you do a ballad and then, mm-hmm. you know, you do this, you do that. You know, it's the same formula. And until that formula stops working, well, unfortunately, we're all going to suffer. We're all going to suffer.
And we are. Yeah.
I actually blame the new Taylor Swift record on giving me a toothache and me having to go get root canal in the crown.
Yeah,
because I think I was listening to it at night and I was grinding my teeth or something like that. I think I fucked up my teeth.
Curse you, Taylor Swift.
I was like, yeah, I was so disturbed by it.
It's kind of funny to hear you saying this because, I mean, one of the things that, I mean, I think the reputation of Pretty Boy Floyd is that they were, you know, you were coming along and taking what other people had done and without realizing the spin that you were kind of putting on things that, you know, a lot of people didn't get it. I feel like, you know, and yeah, you had a style and yeah, you played tribute to things that had come before, but it was distinctive in its own way. The energy and just the structures of the songs and the way you did it. I mean, and even this latest album, I mean, the way you managed to go back to that same period, right? And recreate it. I mean, so it's funny to just kind of hear you talking about the formulas and this and that when I think a lot of people might assume Pretty Boy Floyd was a formula band. And I mean, not saying you didn't have one, but I think that people might be underselling what you did.
Thank you for that. You know, I think actually, if you listen to the Leather Boys record, I think it sounds different than the records that were coming out towards the tail end of the 80s. Everybody was definitely following the formula, using kind of like the same producers. And, our record, I mean, the guitars are just, you know, they sound like a chainsaw, you know? The guitars sound like a chainsaw. The songs, we played them faster because we wanted it to have like more of a live vibe. And we used to play those songs faster vibe, you know? And the producer was in there. I was like, oh, maybe we should slow down some of the tempos on some of these songs. Because, obviously our demos were maybe a little bit slower, but when we were doing them live, we were playing them faster. So obviously we could have went that route and said, oh, you know what, we need to slow this down and make it a little bit more Unskinny Bop sounding, you know, with that But, you know, me and, you know, me and Steve, we were always like, no, when we play the song live, we're like, no. So, yeah, so we followed a formula in a sense of like, of our heroes, like, you know, obviously Motley Crue and Kiss and, you know, the Sweet and all that stuff. But I think the record had like a little bit of a rawness to it, you know, and we didn't get played on the radio a lot. So it wasn't getting force fed down your throat. And, I think, you know, we built, this kind of like, we did like nonstop touring and, so we had like more of a grassroots street kind of word of mouth kind of following, where it was like, you know, when the radio disappeared, like, so did like half of our fans, you know, it wasn't like that.
Yes, it's, you know, and I was actually mentioning this to Brett earlier today that we're talking about it. And it's like, yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like that. The sound of like a Flesh and Blood by Poison doesn't sound like what, you know, Leather Boys with Electric Toys sounds like it is a different sound. And I was talking about to him, I mean, I know it's tough to keep up, and you're talking about finding music, and you have to really look for the music in some ways now, but there's a lot of bands out there. There are this new glam sleaze kind of thing that, and it's, you, I mean, you maybe you're familiar with them, maybe you aren't, but a lot of them sound closer to me to Pretty Boy Floyd than to Poison or you know, even to like, it seems like, I really think a lot of people were influenced by your sound there and are emulating in bands like Wigwam and Crazy Licks and maybe a little bit more sleaze, but maybe my new favorite is one called The New Roses. I have this great song called Life's Not Easy for a Boy with Long Hair. And, you know, it's like, I feel like there was more influence from you guys maybe than as your record sales might have told people.
I if that's the case, I hope so. That'd be cool. It would be cool to know that. Obviously, it's become obviously when our record first came out, it wasn't a cool thing to like Pretty Boy Floyd. You know, we got, you know, shunned by the public and as being, you know, a Poison clone or this clone or, you know, just a crappy band with makeup or something like that. But you know what? Same thing happened with Kiss. Same thing happened with Motley Crue, you know, when they first came out. They said the same things about, you know, Alice Cooper. They said the same thing about all these bands when they first came out, you know. And what was I getting at? I don't even know what I was getting at.
Well, just kind of the influence that you might have, you know. Like, I now I want to send you. You say you listen to these albums on YouTube. I'm like, man, just sit down and listen to Crazy Licks. I think you'll be like, oh, yeah, they dug us. Like, it's a cool thing to think about.
I was listening to a lot of the Swedish bands that were coming out, you know, like, yeah. Hardcore Superstar and, yeah, Crash Diet and stuff, and I was feeling a little bit of influences of Sigur Rós on that stuff, and whether it is, I don't know, but I'm glad to see that there's still bands out there still, you know, pounding the pavement and not trying to do something current with the times, you know, to try and sell some records. You know, just, you know, people are just like saying, you know, like, hey, this is who we are, like it or not, love it or hate us, we don't care, this is what we do.
There's a lot more, I think, that people realize. It's just that it's such a different, I mean, where do you find them? You don't have a, you know, a Headbangers Ball on a, you know, that's going to introduce you to the new songs every week on a Much Music or, you know, MTV or whatever, you know, Power Hour. We're in Canada, so we can mention that. With no relation to the other Pretty Boy Floyd, so you can't blame us for that. We didn't do anything. That other band.
Are you guys in Canada? Is
it where bet. You bet it. We're fucking freezing.
I got a beef with you guys, man.
No, I'm saying we didn't do it, whatever it was.
I got a beef with you guys. Funny. If you want, I'll tell you the interesting story about why we can't get into Canada, but it's pretty funny.
Oh please, I want to hear it.
Yeah,
you want to hear it? Okay. Yeah. So many years ago, there was this guy who I think was like maybe like it was like 2008, 2007, or something like that. This guy hired us to play this festival in Calgary.
Oh, so, shit! That's where we are. We're Calgarians.
That's where we are.
Oh, yeah. We didn't know you were here. How'd we miss that?
Okay, it was some festival in Calgary, right? So we, you know, this is, and this was our first time going back into Canada since we had toured as in like, you know, 89, 90, 91, you know. We didn't know about work permits or anything like that, you know, and all that jive and stuff like that. But, you know, we assumed that the promoter knew what we needed to get into the country. And so we showed up there, and, you know, they were like, hey, so what are you going to do? We're like, well, we're playing this festival, blah, blah, blah. They look it up on the, you know, the internet, but and they're like, oh, they're, you know, they're selling tickets and they're serving alcohol. You need work permits. And I'm like, well, yeah, I think the promoter is supposed to have work permits for us here. And they're like, yeah, no, we have nothing here. So they throw us in a holding tank and send us back.
Holy shit. Oh. You're kidding.
And, yeah, no. And then many years later, it was, we had just hired Ben Graves. It was our second show that we were playing with Ben. And I wanted to make sure there's no problem. We had three sold out shows, I think, in like Ottawa and Montreal and Quebec, like the Rock Pile or something like that, in those little areas over there, more in the east. And I told the promoter, I go, look, make sure that we can get into the country. Make sure all the paperwork is filed. Go down to the consulate, do whatever you're going to do. I'm going to send you scans of our passports. And make sure everything is done correctly. I don't want to waste anybody's time. I don't want to, like, you know, fly there and get denied or whatever. Something will happen. But just please make sure that we can get into the country. And so he came back to us and he said, everything is great. And so I'm like, okay, great. So we get there and we're going through freaking customs again. And I'm the first one up there. And they're like, I see you tried to enter the country illegally. I'm like, no, I didn't try to enter the country illegally. I go, we were playing a show, and the guy didn't file for work permits and put us in the holding tank, and he sent us back. And then she starts digging deeper into looking into our past, and she's like, oh, I see here that you were arrested in 1991 for this and blah, blah, blah. That's a felony in our country. And I'm like, really? 1991? Come on. I'm like, I go, I forgot about that. And I go, I don't even think I was ever convicted of it or anything like that. I think I paid like $100 fine or something like that. And it was over. I think it was fighting or something like that at some place in Texas or something. I got into a fist fight. And then, so they denied us getting into the country again. And I'm like, oh, are you freaking kidding me? We just flew here. And I'm like, you know what? I go, you know who you're fucking? I go, you're fucking over your own fucking country. True. I go, we're coming here to bring income into your country. The shows are sold out. They're going to sell, you know, these people paid tickets. You know, we're putting people to work at the venues. And, you know, it's going to make money in your country. I go, do you not see that? And she was just a mega bitch. And so she put us in the holding tank. And I made a call to the promoter. The promoter comes down there and he's like, oh my God. He's like, well, I went to the concert. They said everything was fine. Everything was ordered. They can get in here and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh my God. He's like, three sold out shows. I'm a small time promoter. And I literally put down like $25,000 and, you know, renting the venues and the sound systems and blah, 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 and all this other stuff. I got sold out shows and tickets sold. And he's like, if you don't let him into the country, I'm going to kill myself. And literally, literally, when he said that, they took him into custody and they handcuffed him. And they're like, what are you doing? And they're like, well, you just threatened your life. We have to, we're going to bring you to get psychiatrically evaluated.
Oh, wow.
So then one of the people there was nice and they said, look, you can get into the country. This is what you got to do. You got to follow the protocol. You got to get these minister pardons. Where, you know, the Minister of Canada will say, oh, it's okay. They can come into the country from this time period to this time period, and they just have to pay a fee. But I've looked into it, and the problem is it's like you have to have an attorney do it, and the attorney will charge you money, and I think it's somewhere around $400 to $600 a member.
Wow.
For each time you want to come there. Yeah, so it just gets, like, expensive. So when you're all done with it, you know, it's like, maybe $3,000, $4,000after you're all done with it. But and if we're, you know, if we're going to play shows for, you know, $2,500, that's $7,500, and you know it's going to cost us, you know, $4,000. We're left over with $3,500. That's enough to pay for, you know, plane tickets and transportation. We'll pretty much be going there for free.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it sucks, and you know, and I don't know how, you know, rest in peace, Lemmy. Jesus Christ, how he used to get into the country all the time.
Yeah, no, no.
Same thing with, right? You know, Tommy Lee. I know he's gotten into the country several times, and that guy was in jail. You know.
Well, you know, I mean, maybe it's only worth it if you're able to have these big extended tours where you're touching on like 10, 15 different cities, as opposed to the smaller 3 and 4 venues.
I wish we were big enough to do 10 cities across Canada. I don't know if we are. No one has ever come to us and said, hey, I want to do 12 Pretty White Floyd shows. They're all going to sell out.
I think we can all agree, though, that whole thing that happened at the border, it's Brett's fault.
By blaming on you.
Wait, what?
Brett, why did you have to do that?
Why would I not let you in?
Yeah, it sucks. So I guess we're not going to be able to get you up here, which is too bad. That was the next question.
We want to get up there. I mean, literally, we played every single country. We never had a problem getting in anywhere. I mean, Jesus Christ, with China, Japan, Australia, I mean, France, Italy, Belgium, the UK, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, Germany. We played everywhere. South America, Mexico City. We cannot get into our country that is our fucking neighbor. I don't fucking get it.
We had to build to keep out you immigrants.
Yes, she said something. She's like, well, people try to come over here when they commit acts of crime in the United States, and they try to declare the diplomatic immunity and stuff like that, and it costs us a lot of money to, do all the paperwork for all that kind of stuff and everything. And I'm like, look, if I wanted to live here, I'd be living here. I go, I have no interest in living in Canada right now, you know. Sorry.
No,
I'm happy in sunny. I'm happy in.
It's freezing here.
Sunny Southern California, where it's 80 degrees in freaking January. I'm good.
I get it. No, you know what? The amount of horror stories that we've heard about Canadian customs and, you know, what goes on. And more than once, we've had a show that was delayed 2-3 hours where we're waiting to see a band and it was customs. You know, they can't get here or something like that. It's just, it is brutal. It's, yeah.
Well, I mean,
I think
driving
across, I think they're a little bit more forgiving. They'll say like, okay, we're going to give you a 3-day pass, give us $300. I think they're a little bit more forgiving when they do that, and they make you sign some sort of paperwork saying, okay, you're going to stay here and you're going to be coming across the border, leaving on this date. But they make you sign some sort of paper and you give them $300 and they let you in they give you like a whatever, a 3-day pass or something like that. I think driving across, but they still give you a hard time.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, I think it's because we give you guys a hard time getting into our country too, so you give us a hard time getting into your country.
I mean, I'm Canadian, and I've been given a hard time coming back into Canada as well. So you never know.
You're a Canadian, and you come to the U.S. and then you go back into Canada, and they give you a hard time getting back into your own country.
Yes,
that's funny.
Yeah, I know. No, yeah.
For you.
That's funny.
Makes you feel better.
I've never had that problem, you know.
Yeah, it's one of those cases where I'm like, if I don't have a problem getting into the US, and I have less problem now. When I was younger, I had more problems. But I have less problems now.
You still got lots of problems.
But when I'm coming back in here, it's just like it's one or the other. It's never both, but it's always one or the other.
Wow. So yeah. So you guys have a hard time just getting back into your own country. That's just something wrong there. You know.
It's honestly why I don't leave. It's just sick. It's why I stay. I don't leave. I don't go anywhere. It's the reason why I stay in my house. I don't go. I don't go outside. I don't have to.
I don't even want to go on the street because I could be deported to some country that I don't even know where I'm from.
Hell, I was born in Denmark. I don't want them to know that. I mean, I've been here forever since I was a kid. But are you kidding?
We just found out you're an illegal alien in Canada.
That's right. I'm a dreamer.
Let's alert the border patrol.
I was a little kid, like I say. I'm a dreamer.
Go get him.
Oh shit, man! We have spent so little time talking about the new album. It's been a conversation more than anything else.
Let's
focus here.
Okay,
we can do it. If we really work at it.
Oh man! All right, let's go with this one.
Like I said, I'm unrehearsed. I'm off the cuff, and I am I'm unfiltered. So.
You're awesome, Christy. Yeah. You're awesome, man. Christy, whatever. You're not Chris Christie. That's a whole other mess.
No, please, no.
No, that's you're definitely not that. Okay, so let's look at the latest album. Like I say, Public Enemies. We think it's fantastic. We actually had Steve on a few December. And he was talking about it to us, and that was through Frontiers. and then we,
have been the joy of an interview. No,
no, he's a little less, what's the word? Gregarious than you. Nice, but he's not as, I mean, for instance, we had asked him, asking for some good stories, and he's telling us a story about, this one time that this girl's screaming in the bus because some guy passed out on her and they couldn't get him off her. And, but he wouldn't tell us who. And we're like, come on, we need to know who that is. And he's like, oh, no, we still tour with him. And things like that. We're like, come on, man.
There's many of those stories. Yeah,
I bet. More than one person passed out on a girl and they couldn't get up, huh?
You know what? Some of that stuff's a fog to me, and I don't know if I want to remember some of that stuff. So yeah.
So we'll move past that. So we'll go on to the new. We'll go on to the album though, because there's songs on here. Obviously, there's new songs, and there's also songs that you guys have. In some form or another, they've been out there before, be it their demos or whatever, right? And so this is the definitive version of these songs, isn't it? This is the one, if you're going to listen to these songs, this is it. This is the album to do it on. This is how they're supposed to sound.
Yeah, there was in this day and age, how it happens on YouTube, I find demos floating around, or I find websites selling demos and stuff. I who's putting these together? I have no freaking idea. But obviously there's some funny stories actually to some of these songs. Obviously, back in 87, when we started out, we were playing Shock the World. That was on one of our first demos. We were playing 7 Minutes in Heaven. We actually even one time we had played at Cazares and we had opened up our set with Feel the Heat. We played the song one time live.
Oh, wow. Is that old?
Wow.
Yeah. Minutes in Heaven. And, we knew that, obviously that one's been on some different things.
Yeah, there's been a couple of times.
But we didn't know Feel the Heat was around for that long.
Yeah, Feel the Heat was around for that long. And then, obviously, We Can't Bring Back Yesterday. That's been on YouTube, and it's been kind of a dedication to Vinny's passing. Someone made a really nice montage of Vinny, and they put that song together. But that song originally started out as a song called Summer Love, which was on our Porn Stars record. And there was a guy, Todd Meager, who was a go-to songwriter, lyricist kind of guy. And he came in there and changed the chorus and some of the lyrics during the verses and came out with this iconic chorus of We Can't Bring Back Yesterday. And then we just gave it the Floyd treatment. And so that song's been around, floating around in different versions for a while as well, you know. So, yeah, there's definitely some songs and some demos, obviously, that, you know, if a diehard fan wants to try and, you know, get a hold of it, yeah, they could probably hear some of these songs on the Real Raw Firm. Raw form. say that 7 times. Yeah. So, but you know what? These were songs that we had picked out, and obviously we did some changes to some of them. We Got the Power was kind of like a song that had like a different chorus and a different, you know, it had like a different vibe to it and a different chorus and everything. And we had changed it around, and we really wanted to make this like a true follow-up to the Leather Boys record. And we worked really hard on trying to capture that vibe and that sound of the of that, you know, 80s time era.
Yeah, there's no question, because, yeah, when you listen to it, and even the production, like, I actually was really impressed with the production of the album as well, because it has a really good sound, and you can hear everything coming through. So that's one of the things I appreciated about it.
I got to attest that to Cameron Webb, who mixed it. And the guy is, he's been a friend of mine for years. And, you know, his credits are more in line of, like, you know, Megadeth, Social Distortion, and Pennywise, and Motorhead, and all that kind of stuff, you know. But he's done, he's made great records. And when I asked him, I said, hey, I go, do you think you can make an 80s record? And he's like, are you kidding me? Yes. He's like, my God, I listened to Dr. Feelgood, you know, so many times. And I constantly refer, use that as a reference for when I'm mixing songs, you know, probably one of the best sounding records put out during that time era. Oh, it was Dr. Feelgood. And So he did it, but, you know, obviously we were limited with our budget, you know, of what we could do. And he took over the project after we had already recorded all the basic tracks. So he was limited to what he could do, but he did a freaking great job on making it sound, having that, you know, that 80 sound, and just making it sound like a $300,000 record that you had made in the '80s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we worked really hard on it too. You know, Steve worked really hard. I think his voice sounds exactly, you know, like it does on the Leather Boys record. And, we tried to follow the same formula with, the big rock riffs, you know, and having the big anthem choruses. So, and then we also, you know, we tried to follow the same formula by putting an unreleased Motley Crue song, like we did with Toast of Town on this record, with the Leather Boys record, which is the song Run for Your Life.
Nice. Yeah, that's interesting. Even I didn't realize that.
But yeah, that's an unreleased Motley Crue song written by Nikki Sixx. It was, I remember I had gotten this demo tape, I think, I don't know when it was, maybe 85, 86 or something like that. It was called Shout at the Demos. I think it was, it was a cassette tape, Shout at the Demos. And I think it was a song that they had worked up for Shout at the Devil, but just, never made it on the Shout at the Devil record. And I had it lying around on a cassette tape. And boy, that was hard for me to transfer over to trying to decipher what the hell was going on it with a cassette tape going. I thought it was a cool song. I thought it was like, you know what? Let's put another Motley song, unreleased Motley song on the record. You know, because when we were playing Toast of Town, before we had gotten our record deal, and nobody even knew it was a Motley Crue song. You know, until unless you were like some diehard fan and had the leather records released, because it didn't come out until many, many years later when I think Nicky repackaged it and put, you know, Stick to Your Guns and Toast to the Town on the record, along with, you know, some original, like the original Too Fast for Love, where it had like the weird intro going into it. But, you know, we love the old Motley stuff. You know, we love the, you know, everything up to Dr. Field. We, you know, all those records are just, you know, great freaking records, you know, well, with the exception of Theater of Pain.
That's funny. Theater of Pain, I think that was my first Motley Crue album.
Theater of Pain, you know, I mean, obviously it had their biggest, probably one of their biggest songs, Home Sweet Home, on it, but you know, I mean, the rest of the record it's kind of silly, you know. Raise your hands to rock, rock. Raise your hands to rock, rock.
Your Vince Neil is awesome.
Yeah, that's tremendous.
Rock, rock. You know, keep your eye on the money. I don't know. There was just some silly songs on there. Louder Than Hell, though, was a great song. Though. I like that song.
You remember more than I do, which is that's something else. I need to ask. We meant to ask Steve. What does SATA mean? And what does it stand for?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have no idea. We just came up with some letters and we put them together, and that's what we came up with.
I think if we put our heads together, we can come up with something next time you're asked. Right now, yeah.
Actually, it does mean something, but I'm not going to tell anybody. It was better than calling it intro.
when
we were working on the record, you know, I was constantly making these rough mixes. And I would put all the songs on there where, you know, Steve and I would listen to them and go. And I would always put like number one intro. I'm like, that's a horrible title for a song, intro.
Brett, let me have this one here. Let me just try and work my charm a little bit. Hey, I know you don't want to tell anybody or anybody else, but how about us?
What?
I tried.
because we're the good Canadians.
That's right.
Okay, I'll give you the S word. The S word is sinners.
Sinners. Sinners. All right. All right.
Sinners
That's
at
good.
The arcade.
Sinners. A T A. No, you'll never get it. You could like literally. If we played, if you gave me a penny for every guess that you did, I'd be a millionaire by the time you guys are done.
I don't have a million pennies to give you. So yeah. Oh, you're killing us here. All right. That's good. That's at least something, you know?
Yeah.
That's great.
We'll leave that to, stump the trunk.
There you go. Now,
what does SAT mean? What does SATA mean on the Motley on the Pretty Boy Floyd record? Stump the trunk. What do I mean?
You got to put it in like a time capsule or something like that. 100 years from now, somebody, you know, open it up and go, shit, finally, you know. That's what
the
it
only
meant.
People who, like 150
the only, two,
old,
the only two people who know what it means is me and Steve, and I guarantee you probably Steve even forgot what it means now.
That's great. So you must have.
I think I texted it to him one time, and I'm like, yeah, sinners, blah, 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 SATA. And he goes, cool.
So it sounds like you guys must have a shitload of other songs that you just haven't, they haven't been in demos. They haven't been like, they're still just sitting there. Is there like a huge catalog backlog of Pretty Boy Floyd music, or are you guys getting close to having used it all up?
No, oh my God. You know, when we were getting ready to do our second record, I mean, literally our A&R guy had gotten fired from MCA and a new guy took over, literally hated us. And he just
literally,
yeah, you know, he hated us. I mean, We could have brought him. We could have brought him Living on the Prayer in 1984. He would have been like, I don't hear it, you know. So, yeah. The guy just hated us, and I think after we had given him like 100 freaking songs that he had us flying all over the United States, writing with so many different people, that I kind of got this vibe that, okay, we're never going to do a record with this guy. It's just never going to happen. But then he came up with this brilliant idea. Every day it'd be something different. It'd be like, you know what we need? We need a ballad that sounds like More Than Words. You know, just guitar and vocals or something like that. And at the time we were working with Eddie Winrick and Tom Hewlett, who were managing Warrant. Those were our managers at the time. And so they found this songwriter guy. They even gave us some Janie Lane ballads that later came out. Like I think they the song called Don't Say Goodbye.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you can find it on on YouTube.
Great, nobody's a bigger Janie Lane fan than me, so yeah, I'm familiar. Okay, so in fact, I had a couple questions about that actually. But go ahead, please.
Yeah,
go.
Janie Lane is like the Billy Joel of 80s rock, you know. The guy's just incredible, great songwriter, great melodies, great lyricist, and he's great. So yeah, Janie had given us some ballads because the guy wanted ballads, you know. And Janie had even given us some ballads that he was just like, yeah, I don't hear it. You know, and we heard the song Don't Say Goodbye, and we're like, my God, that's a freaking great freaking song. So we give it to him, and then, you know, and then I don't know who found this other guy who had this other song called Give Me a Reason to Stay. It was a song, and it sounded very similar to, you know, it was just acoustic guitar and vocals. And it's a great freaking song. I mean, so we had given him maybe six ballads, you know, songs written by Gene, songs written by other people, you know, professional songwriters and everything. And he's just like, yeah, it's almost there. And that's when I was just like, you know, I'm fucking done, man.
Yeah.
I'm done, man. I mean, literally, I'm like a dog chasing my tail here for 2 years. It's just never going to happen. And then obviously, you know, I think just at that time, Alice in Chains had come out with their EP. In fact, we actually heard the Alice in Chains EP before it even came out, because Vinny used to play in a cover band with Jerry Cantrell. So when we went up and played Seattle, you know, Jerry and Lane came on the bus and they left us this cassette tape behind, and I was listening to it. And I was like, going, holy shit, this is like amazing. You know, I just thought it was incredible. Everybody else was like, shut that shit off. I'm in the back of the bus every day. They're like, shut that shit off. I'm like, are you kidding me? This is great. But yeah, so I just knew it wasn't going to happen, and I didn't want to waste my time anymore. And I was like, okay, let's go back to school. Let's figure out plan B here, because I'm not going to be one of those freaking, you know, cases where, I'm going to be working at some, you know, shit job and just getting by for the rest of my life. So, and that's what I did. And I think the band tried to carry on with Ariel for, I think, like another year and a half, 2 years. And they started wearing those ridiculous outfits and started working with Billy Coyne. And then nothing happened. And I was right.
Well, you know, since you brought up Janie.
So like I said, yeah, there's hundreds of songs that we have lying around.
Awesome. Like, I'm guessing now, kind of listening to that kind of makes a little sense, but I'll just bring it up, like you say, Janie Lane, he had his solo album Back Down to One, and you did on Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll. You did Down to One, and you also did Live Without You, which was Face on his, on Face. The Warrant Under the Influence album.
Yes.
Yeah, so yeah, I was just kind of wondering how you got those songs, and because, like I said, I'm just, you know, such a huge fan. So when I heard those on their albums, I was, oh wow, didn't catch, you know, I didn't expect that, right? And
I was like,
wow, that was, you know, it was a pleasant surprise.
You know, I was working with Kerry Kelly. We were doing this band. It was me and Kerry Kelly. We were doing this band, and we were called New World Idols. That was the name of the band, and And Janie was down there writing a lot with Kerry, and I was coming down there every once in a while listening to some songs, or he would send me some things you know, via email or whatever. And I was throwing him ideas, Karen Kelly and stuff, giving him ideas, and everybody was just writing. And I think, you know, out of that whole bunch came, you know, Janie's solo record, came Saints of the Underground as well. But there was like a whole plethora of songs coming up. And I remember there was some songs that I thought were really cool. And I asked Janie, I'm like, hey, is it okay if I record these tunes? And he's just like, yeah, go for it. And he actually liked what I did with Face, how I kind of took a part of the song out that I just thought didn't need to be there.
I noticed that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I just took that, you know, that whole Face part out, you know, and I was like, you know, it just sounds a lot better as just, you know, the chorus being, you know, Live Without You, you know? So, so I worked on that record with Carrie Kelly and we were doing New World Idols. And actually, if you go and, you know, we had a lot of interest when we were doing that, and we actually recorded a Billy Joel song for Agent Cody Banks. It was on the Agent Cody Banks soundtrack with Frankie Muniz, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
It was a movie that I don't think anybody cared about. anyway, they gave us a couple. Yeah. which is pretty much like almost all of the movies that are coming out nowadays. Yeah, so it was a band that we were trying, and at one point, you know, we had some offers for some pretty cool deals, and then just some personal life things got in the way, and we just kind of like, you know, we split up, you know, from that. But yeah, we had some things going on there for a while. We had Roy Thomas Baker producing and mixing our stuff and everything, and he was my next door neighbor, so I had him involved, and we were doing like showcases down at the Viper Room during the day, and like, you know, three or four labels would show up every single time, and we'd get some offers, and I think, you know, we got a little greedy. We're like, we can get a better offer than that. And then the offer started drying up, and then some personal things came back, and then we had to kind of like move on from that. That's how I recorded those songs. And, you know, that's how the whole, I think a lot of that Saints of the Underground came about as well. And Jamie's solo record. And that's how I got to put those songs on the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll record.
That's awesome. You know, Carrie Kelly is one of those guys. It's like, oh yeah, there's somebody we have to talk to. He's, you know, obviously got a lot of history. He's listed, I think, as a producer on Public Enemies, isn't he?
Yeah.
And it was kind of, what did he bring to the album? You guys know what you're doing. So, what does he bring? Obviously he worked in the band before himself. So
it's great. It's great having another, an outside ear, obviously, to throw some input in there. When we were going down doing the basic tracks down at Carrie Kelly's house, he's got a studio in his house. I mean, I have a studio here in Burbank, but it's a small studio. I don't have a drum room anymore. I used to have a drum room, but I don't have it anymore. But Terry's got his house set up where you could do the drums like downstairs and the control rooms like upstairs. And so we went there and we did the drum tracks and the basic tracks there, you know, like just like the guitars and bass. And we did the drums, and we had Chad Stewart from Faster Pussycat play the drums on it. So it was good to have Carrie down there. Carrie was like, hey, you know what? What about if we don't go back to the verse after the Feel the Heat? Let's take Feel the Heat. So we were going back after the guitar solo, we were going back to the first verse and then going into the chorus. And Carrie was like, you know what? What about if we just take that out and just go right back into the chorus after the guitar solo? And we tried it and it worked. And it was stuff like that.
Let's talk about Artists Worldwide then, because, you know, it's sure. Amazing to me that you've managed to grow it so well.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's not like, you know, it's not like you were, you didn't go to school for this or anything, did you?
I don't think there is a school that you can really go for being a talent agent, or there's not a school to work in the music industry, you know, because anything they teach you is nothing that you're going to be able to apply to the craziness that goes on in the music industry.
Well, and I think it'll be out of date within 2 minutes anyway.
Yeah. I mean, what I did was, I think in 92, I went back to school and I got a paralegal degree, and I was contemplating being an attorney. So I had called up our attorney that was working for Pretty Boy Floyd. His name was Robert Toro. And I started working for him, and then he kind of put together this label that kind of merged into Relativity, R-E-D. So he brought me over there with him. So I was there from, I don't know, 6-7 years working on the record label side of it, you know. And so I went from being in the band, doing paralegal stuff, and I was actually doing some stuff with Henry Rood, who was an attorney at the time. And I remember when I first started going over there, he was doing like a lot of bankruptcies for like Rat and Warrant and all that stuff, you know, all these bands that had signed like big merchandising deals, but, you know, they weren't able to tour and complete it, you know. So I learned a lot of stuff from those people that I was surrounded by over at Relativity, as far as like the business side of, which is stuff I wish I would have known, you know, many years before we had gotten into Pretty Boy Floyd. And then that kind of dismantled, and I decided to open up a talent agency. And obviously everyone said, oh, you're going to fail, you're not going to be able to compete. And I'm like, you know what, I don't want to compete with, you know, those ICMs and the William Morrises and the CAAs. I go, I want to start an agency for the bands that can't go there because they can't even get their phone calls answered and nobody even gives a shit about them. And I know what that's like because we were at William Morris and every tour that we ever did was from phone calls that, you know, me or Steve made to get tours, you know, whether it be LA Guns, whether it be Shock on Messiah, we put that all together. From making, hey, what are you doing? Are you touring? Are you doing this? What are you doing? I mean, he literally did nothing for us until we got the tour. We got, you know, then I would say, hey, you know, Shock and Messiah wants to go out, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And then he would, you know, book the tour. But yeah, so I started Artists for White about 20 years ago, and I just started calling up, like, you know, people that I knew, friends. Hey, what are you doing? Are you playing? Do you need an agent? You know, there's obviously a market still for you out there. And then it just started growing from, word of mouth, you know, hey, who's doing this for you? Hey, I see you playing over here and you're going there, you're going to South America. I see you're doing this European tour. Who's doing this all for you? And, everything just grew by word of mouth and referrals. And now we've gotten, you know, into our 20th year. And we built up a pretty cool company that I'm pretty proud of.
You got some really cool artists, obviously, on there. I mean,
amazing, like people that we just love.
I love, like I said, I love all types of music. You know, it's like I'm not like one of those guys that's just gonna like listen to 80s rock. You know, I love old school punk rock. I love new wave. There's so many bands that I just love. You know. And obviously there's even some current bands that I really like as well too, you know? So, I'm a music lover, and everything that I've done in my life has revolved around music. I haven't done anything else with my life that hasn't revolved around music ever since I was, you know, 16 years old up until now, where I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be 50 next week. So, I've been doing this for a long time. And the cool thing about it, I think the cool thing about, you know, having, somebody at an agency who's been there, been on the record side of it, also been on the touring side of it, I can relate to every sort of issue, every sort of problem, that might arise when bands are going on tours, or even just be someone that they can talk to and that they can relate to. I mean, that's part of being an agent as well, is kind of being like, just a good ear, you know, a good listener, and, knowing that somebody cares about you and somebody is looking out for you and trying to, you know, do things to better your career and, you know, forward your career and make you money down the road, you know, and we go above and beyond just being just a booking agency. We know we help bands get record deals. We help bands, you know, do television commercials, try and place their songs in, you know, whatever it might be, a video game here and there or something. You know, we do whatever we possibly can to try and, you know, make our artists money and do right things for them.
I'm guessing you're not booking a lot of tours in Canada, though. Experiences.
You know, it was kind of funny. I had the Exploited that was supposed to play a show up in Canada, and they couldn't get into Canada. And there was like there was a pretty big riot. There was a pretty big riot because it was like a festival, and there was a pretty big riot where they were like, flipping over cars and like lighting shit on fire and stuff and everything. And Waddy, he loved it. He was just like. I was like, hey man, I'm so sorry you didn't get into Canada. He goes, what, are you kidding me? He goes, I couldn't buy this kind of publicity.
you can book us Little Caesar up here or something. That'd be cool. I mean, you know, throw us a bone. You know,
I do stuff. I mean, LA Guns comes up there.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I mean, I have a lot of my bands coming up there and doing shows. So you know, I mean, I was doing Faster Pussycat for the longest time too. And they were constantly going up there, you know. And, yeah, I have a lot of bands that are going up there. Puddle of Mud, obviously, has been up there a few times. So, yeah, I try to do everything in my life to keep the music scene alive and going, you know.
And
that's my goal.
And it's true that you know now that if they can't get up here, it's Brett's fault. So you're okay with that now? You
he's gonna come to terms with that.
Yeah,
you know, if there comes another time, I'm gonna say, hey, you know what, this guy Brett said I can get in here. Here's his number. Can you call him up, man?
Yeah, see how that works.
You
for
call
you.
Call him up. He said I could get in here.
Just drop my name. So, if they call, I'll say, oh, totally, it's fine. Just let him in. They're good. They're good.
Yeah. And then the next time you try to get back in, they'll be like, sorry, we can't let you back in.
That's right.
We're trying to do some illegal shit with Pretty Boy Floyd. yeah. Sorry, you're gonna have to leave the country now.
I think we might have a show title now, Illegal Shit with Pretty Boy Floyd. That's
I'll be like wandering around California. Excuse me. You know Christy Majors? I'm looking for a place to stay.
I'm homeless because of him.
Yeah.
Well, you know what that brings up? That's a perfect transition because, I mean, you're what, like 18, 19 years old when you get out to Los Angeles? Like, you get out there, do you know anybody? I mean, what's a kid from New York doing in, like, what's Hollywood like when you get out there in that
oh
era?
Oh, my God. You know, I feel sorry for the people who didn't get a chance to live that era of the Sunset Strip in the 80s, and obviously I was on the tail end of it, but it was just incredible. I mean, because I'm coming from New York, had a small little scene, and it was very diverse. It was, you know, you had your thrash bands like Anthrax, SOD, Overkill, all that kind of stuff that was really popular on the East Coast during that time. And then you had like this underground kind of rock scene going on with like Smash Gladys and Princess Pang and Law and Order and stuff like that, you know. And and then you had your punk bands. So it was very diverse. When I come here, everybody's got long freaking hair, dressed all glammed out, and you know, there was something to do every freaking night, you know, Cat House on Tuesdays. I'm sorry, No Bozo Jam at the Whiskey on Mondays. And then English Acid on Wednesdays, Bordellos on Thursdays, and then Fridays and Saturdays where you could take your pick. You could go to the Sunset Strip or you can go out to the Country Club. And then Sundays was judging the Miss Kazari's Dance Contest.
Nice.
Which was always fun. but it was incredible. There were so many bands and so many musicians, and there was people that I had known, you know, like Kelly Nichols from LA Guns. He was playing in a band in New York City, and he was originally from New York City. So he comes out here, and his first band that he was in was Faster Pussycat. Then he gets into a motorcycle accident, I think, and his knee got all screwed up. So he was in the hospital. Fastpitch had to record the record, so they replaced him with Eric Stacy. Then he gets out of the hospital, and he's okay. He joins LA Guns, and he gets another record deal. I'm like, Jesus Christ, you've been out there for a year. You got two record deals with two different bands? I'm like, that's freaking crazy, you know? And it's just like, he's like, dude, literally, they're like handing him out.
Candy.
Yeah. So I was like, you know what? I got to go. So I bought a van and I drove out here and I was kind of staying in the van, living in the back of the van. I had a little membership over at Bally's. And that's where I used to go shower and shave. And I was sleeping in the van. And when I met the Pretty Boy Floyd guys, they had a little rehearsal space and it had like a shower in the bathroom. And I was like, can I live in here? And they're like, yeah. And so me and Vinny moved in there and we got like little futons and we made, you know, we rigged up this television with coat hangers as an antenna up onto the top of the roof of the building. And so we used to get like maybe like two channels, you know, we had like a little hot plate. And yeah, we just lived in there. But you know, things happened pretty quick for us. I think we played 10 shows and we had gotten our deal.
So yeah, it totally worked out. The candy came your way.
Yeah, you know what? And you know what? People think that it was just handed to us. But you know what? Like, literally, we worked really hard. You know, I mean, we were out every night, like, promoting. I mean, we would, like, literally space things out. Be like, okay, you cover this area. You cover this area. You cover this area. And if there was, like, a big show at the Forum or something or Long Beach or something, we would, you know, we would give girls, like, we would say, hey, here, take these 5,000 flyers and put them on all the cars and stuff. And so we would do that. We worked really hard. And then obviously we did the whole plastering, you know, telephone poles and the walls and everything. We would do, you know, you do that at like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And then, you know, somebody else the next day would cover yours up and then you would go and cover theirs up again. It was like a war, you know? So, yeah, we had worked really hard for those 10 months. So
the stories about the flyering,
and we were lucky.
The stories about the flyering, they're legendary. And yet on the other hand, it's so hard to wrap your head around just how everybody was doing that and the different ways that they would come up to market themselves within a flyer. And I mean, we'll talk about it being the best muff diving champions or whatever, put that in there. And that would lead to, they would have success from that or, you know, poison, you know, using their color green coming just because, you know, it was basically they couldn't give away the paper. So they got it really, really cheap and that became their color. And it's like just this, it's like it's this weird subculture, the flyering thing. It's amazing to hear about.
It, you know, at the end of the night, I mean, look, it was something that needed to be done. Obviously, I did not like doing it. I'm not like,
nostalgic.
I didn't like going around handing out flyers, but you know, I mean, you go grab a $5 bottle of Night Train, chug it all down, and you're literally just wasting. You just be like, hey, come on, hey, Pretty Boy Floyd, hey, you know, it kind of worked. But at the end of the night, that, you know, and they would have, you know, cops obviously going up and down on horseback because there was literally thousands of people walking from the Whiskey to Gazzari's, you know, and in between there was the Roxy and the Rainbow. So it was just, yeah, thousands of people just walking up and down there. And obviously they were going into the shows, you know, like literally almost every night there was, you know, 4 or 5 bands playing somewhere and it was always packed. You know, everybody wanted to see who was going to be the next, you know, big band coming out of Los Angeles. And they wanted to be, you know, first in on that act, you know?
That's cool. Brett, we've had them for Christie's unbelievably long time you've been giving us. It's awesome.